Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a resident, and this is episode 136 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I'm going to be going over immunology for the USMLE Step 1. This will be the first part of this podcast, so let's just jump right into it. Really, immunology, to be perfectly honest, the best way to understand immuno is to kind of get it as a story. If you're able to see how things, you know, all kind of like fit together, things get a lot more intuitive. And the problem is immunology cuts across many, many, many different fields of medicine, right? So it's one of these things that it's almost like a subtle science. But again, if you buckle down and really learn it, it can pay off in spades, especially when you're taking these USMLE exams, most especially USMLE Step 1. And as we're going along, again, I'll try to introduce some clinical vignettes to sort of help you solidify things together. And I guess the way I'll sort of talk about immunology is, I guess I'll maybe start by giving an overview of the immune system, right? So, I mean, we know obviously that the immune system helps you deal with infection, right? It also helps you deal with like cancer, for example, right? And I mean, there's like two big parts of your immune system. There's innate, there's adaptive, and I mean, it's essentially like multiple things kind of working in concert to protect your body as a cohesive whole. And the thing is, for your immune system to do its job, it kind of needs like some means of communication between the different players. These are the cytokines. Actually, towards the end of this immunology review, I will spend some time like really hammering out those cytokines so that you know the high yield ones that you need to keep at the back of your mind for the exam. And then, I mean, just some big groupings you want to be aware of with regards to your immune system, right? We have like the antigen presenting cells, right? There's a bunch of those. Those include things like your macrophages, your B cells, your dendritic cells. Those are your antigen presenting cells. And the big thing you want to know about those is that they all contain our MHC class 2, right? And then we have some things that can help with like opsonization, right? So things like your, you know, like your antibodies, your C3b. C3b is one of your complement proteins. Those things all kind of help with phagocytosis. Phagocytosis is a process that already happens in and of itself, but the opsonins, like these antibodies and the complement proteins, they kind of make that process a lot more efficient. So I guess with regards to differentiating between your innate and your adaptive immune systems, right? Some big things you want to keep in mind. Your innate immune system, you're kind of like born with it, right? So it's kind of like hardwired into your germline, right? So for the most part, your innate immune system is heritable, right? So it's something that's transferred from father to son or mom to daughter or whatever. Basically, it's transferred across generations. So it really doesn't change much. It gives you the same response every single time, right? But your adaptive immune system is actually not heritable, right? It's something that you build as you get exposed to antigen over the course of your life, right? So without exposure to antigen, your adaptive immune system essentially does not kick into gear, right? So it's not heritable for the most part. Again, that's a subtle point, but it's something that's very high yield to remember. And I mean, the thing is, your innate immune system, right, is almost kind of like non-specific. Although, I mean, I guess if you really wanted to drill down, it's kind of specific for like some structures that are shared by like big groups of microbes, right? So those things are called like PAMPs, so pathogen associated molecular patterns. And those PAMPs, right, are things that, you know, we find on like these foreign invaders that are not necessarily found on our cells, right? So a classic one is, for example, like mannose, right? Mannose, the protein, is generally not found on the surfaces of our cells. So if you see mannose on the surface of something, you're like, oh crap, this is bacteria, right? So your innate immune system says, okay, I'm going to go ahead and attack this thing because it has this PAMP, this pathogen-associated molecular pattern. Another high-yield one that is commonly tested on exam is a lipopolysaccharide, right? So like LPS. Remember, LPS is found primarily on the surfaces of gram-negatives, right? So because that LPS is found on the surfaces of gram-negatives, it's something that, again, your innate immune system recognizes and says, okay, it's time to go ahead and kill this bug, right? But again, the thing is, your innate immune system, kind of limited diversity. There's only so many things it can identify. And I mean, it doesn't have any memory. So again, it's because again, it's hardwired, right? It doesn't have like memory like you have for your adaptive immune system. There are actually many things that make up our innate immune system, right? So like all these physical barriers, right? So like your skin, your mucosal surfaces, all these chemicals you make, like lysozyme, for example, right? All these interferons, like interferon alpha, interferon beta, those are all examples of the barriers, right, that constitute the innate immune system. And then all these cells, like your basophils, eosinophils, neutrophils, mast cells, those things are all part of your innate immune system. And also one of your lymphocyte derivatives, your natural killer cells, believe it or not, those are actually a part of your innate immune system. And then, again, complement, your complement proteins, they all make up a part of your innate immune system. And then if you're jumping to the adaptive immune system, right, like your adaptive immune system is a lot more specific, right? Because again, your adaptive immune system is like a system that like is trained, right? So it learns what a specific pathogen looks like, right? Or you can force your immune system to learn. I mean, like you can say, okay, you can either learn the hard way or the easy way, right? So the hard way is you get exposed to like a full-blown infection. Your adaptive immune system learns that infection and says, okay, come next time, I'll deal with you, right? Or you can learn the easy way and get vaccinated, right? That's why I encourage people to get vaccinated, right? So you can learn it the easy way under like, you know, like low stress conditions. It's kind of like being in residency as against being out in the real world. With a vaccine, your body learns those pathogens under low stress conditions, makes antibodies, so that when you get a full-blown infection, you're better able and ready to deal with all those things. So your adaptive immune system, you know, it's super specific, right? It identifies unique pathogens, right? And it certainly has memory, which is something that is kind of different from your innate immune system. And again, remember, your adaptive immune system, it is not hardwired into your genome. And then, like some big parts of your adaptive immune system, right? For the most part, those are kind of like your B and your T lymphocytes. And on like your innate immune system that, you know, uses complement as its like major protein. Your adaptive immune system, the major protein that kind of like floats around in the serum dealing with infection are your antibodies, right? Which are ultimately produced by B cells. And again, remember, your lymphocytes, right, include B cells and T cells. Natural killer cells are actually derived from lymphocytes as well. But your natural killer cells are considered to be a part of your innate immune system. They are not considered to be a part of your adaptive immune system. It's your B and your T lymphocytes that are said to be a part of the adaptive immune system. So let me, I guess, focus a little and talk about the innate immune system, right? So the thing is, your innate immune system, again, like I said, right, you have like your phagocytes, like all these like neutrophils, macrophages, and then all those like other little cells there, basophils, eos, blah blah blah, mast cells, right? And then again, like I said, your NK cells, which are again a lymphocyte derivative, and then your complement proteins, they are all part of your innate immune system. So let's kind of talk about complement. Essentially, complement, again, like I said, they're part of your innate immune system. They're essentially a bunch of proteins that help with the innate immune response. And the thing is, I'll say there are two big things you want to know with regards to the USMLE step one in relation to the complement system. You want to know like the three systems, and you then want to make sure that you know the functions of the complement proteins. Trying to memorize like all the steps of each individual complement cascade makes no sense. I'll probably just spend like a minute or two on like two quick ones, or maybe even actually just one major one, just to kind of like, make you see how it kind of works so that you can have like some understanding to be able to like build a foundation, I guess like a scaffold to memorize the concept. But basically, right, there are like three complement systems, right? There's like the classic one, there's the alternative pathway, and then there's like the mannose binding lectin pathway. Now, the thing is, the classic complement pathway, right, that one essentially involves antibodies. The alternative pathway is the one, I think that's probably the one I'll maybe spend some time describing. That one just kind of starts spontaneously. And then the mannose binding lectin pathway, if you actually really think about it, it's a nice pathway because it's super specific and it's very good at targeting bacteria. And again, like I said, you do need to know the functions of the different complement proteins. That is floridly high yield to know for exams. And the thing is, these complement proteins, they're great. They are awesome for dealing with infection. But you also need to, you know, kind of figure out a way to turn these things off, because if they are running amok, they can cause a lot of trouble in your body, like very serious trouble in your body. So I guess let me pick out one of the pathways, and I think I probably want, let me just go ahead and use the alternative pathway and kind of describe how this complement system works. Again, just kind of like setting the stage. Again, you don't necessarily need to memorize every single step. Probably like the next 1 or 2 minutes of what I say, you probably don't need to memorize, but it sort of gives you an understanding of how this complement system kind of plays out. So the thing that happens is that, so say for example, you have like complement protein C3. Okay, that C3, remember I told you that this alternative pathway is kind of spontaneous. The thing is, the C3 is kind of like spontaneously like broken down to like C3A and C3B. The thing is, C3B, remember it's a very good opsonin. That's a high yield thing you want to remember. And the thing is, this C3B, once it's formed, it can actually bind to like an amino group or a hydroxy group on the surface of bacteria, right? And from there, things then proceed further. But if, for example, like you form C3B and there's no amino group, there's no hydroxy group on the surface of bacteria to bind to, the body immediately just quenches it by the C3B like binding to water. But if, let's say, you know, this C3B, you know, finds a hydroxy group on the surface of bacteria, right? It binds, right? That C3B, there's something called factor B that will come and bind to it. And then that C3B that's bound to factor B, there is another thing called factor D. That factor D kind of strolls along, right, and cleaves the C3B bound to factor B complex to like C3BBB, right? C3BBB is known as a C3 convertase. And whenever you see the word convertase after something, it means it can cleave that thing, right? So like C3 convertase has the ability to cleave multiple C3s. C5 convertase has the ability to cleave multiple C5s, right? So C3BBB, right, is C3 convertase. So it can kind of, again, cleave other C3 groups like in a kind of like a continuous chain reaction. And then that C3 convertase, that C3BBB, right, can combine with another C3B, right? So I know you may be saying, oh, Divine, this is kind of ridiculous. Again, this is just for purposes of understanding. You can skip this part if you don't listen to it. But basically, that C3 convertase can bind with another C3B, right? So you can have something like C3BBB, which is the original C3 convertase, and then it joins with another C3B. So it's almost like you have like C3B squared BB, right? That's what's known as a C5 convertase. And then that C5 convertase, again, because it's a convertase for C5, that means it can cleave C5s. So that C5 convertase cleaves other C5 groups to like C5A, C5B. And then that C5B joins up with complement proteins C6 to 9 to form something called the membrane attack complex, right? The membrane attack complex is essentially like forms like a hole and blows up the bacterial cell. So that's kind of like the way the alternative complement cascade works. And then the membrane attack complex C5B, C6, C7, C8, and C9, right? And again, you want to remember some high yield things there, right? So if you have a deficiency of these terminal complement component proteins, right, you can get into some big trouble, right? Like you can have a recurrent like Neisseria infections, both infections with Neisseria meningitis and Neisseria gonorrhea, right? Those are high yield things to know for tests. So I kind of stated earlier that, you know what, this complement system is great, but it's not something, again, you want to work in all the time, right? So you kind of want to be able to turn it off. And towards the end of this, I'll actually talk about a disorder where you don't turn off your complement proteins as you should, and then you begin to get into a lot of trouble, because complements, they can destroy your own cells, they can destroy foreign cells, right? So your body has these mechanisms in place to prevent them from destroying your own cells, for turning them off. So I'll give you some examples of this system. And again, these examples, again, are very high yield to know, because they're actually clinically relevant, right? So there's this protein known as MCP, right? It's found on the surfaces of our cells. It essentially can activate enzymes that would convert C3B, right? Remember, C3B, I said that ultimately it constitutes a part of like a C3 convertase, right? So, and remember that C3B is also an opsonin. That C3B, MCP, can sort of like activate some enzymes, or even there's this thing called factor I that can convert that C3B to like IC3B. IC3B is like the inactive C3B. So again, by essentially taking C3B out of commission, you have no C3 convertase. And then probably the ones that are more clinically relevant, right, are things like CD55 and CD59, right? So the thing is, CD55 is known as a decay accelerating factor, or DAF. Again, you also find it on the surfaces of our own cells. It essentially prevents the formation of the C3 convertase in all the complement pathways, right? So it's pretty good for essentially making that C3 convertase not form. Okay, you'll see why that's important in a second. Another protein that you may also see on exams is like CD59. Again, these are all proteins that turn off the complement cascade. CD59, another name you may see on the MBM is, it's called a protectin. Okay, it actually prevents C9. Remember, I told you that the membrane attack complex includes C5b, C6, C7, C8, and C9. The thing is, all those things need to assemble together. I kind of think of it as like, oh, everyone needs to vote for a decision to be made. All those proteins need to come together for you to form the membrane attack complex. If one is missing, you will not form any membrane attack complex. So the thing is, CD59 actually prevents C9 from being incorporated into the membrane attack complex. And when that happens, you essentially halt the formation of the membrane attack complex. So what's the clinical correlate here, right? They can give you a question about like a young guy, you know, that has like, you know, low hemoglobin. They tell you that he always has like pees like blood in the morning and all that stuff. And he has like thrombosis of like weird arteries. If you see that, you probably want to think about PNH, right? So like paroxysmal or nocturnal hemoglobinuria. The thing about PNH is it effectively involves you having a mutation in a gene called a PIGA. So PIG, like P-I-G-A, like PIGA. If you have the PIGA mutation, then you'll have trouble with GPI anchors, okay? GPI anchors. Now, why are those GPI anchors important? The thing is, I think of those GPI anchors as like sticks that put certain things on the surfaces of your cells, right? So like, for example, you need those GPI anchors to hoist like CD55 and CD59 on the surfaces of your cells, like your red blood cells, for example. So the thing is, if you have this PIGA gene mutation, well, all the best with getting GPI anchors. If you don't have GPI anchors, you'll not be able to hoist CD55, which is decay accelerating factor, and CD59, which is a protectin, on the surfaces of your cells. So the unfortunate thing that happens is because those things that turn off complement are not on your cells, complement can come and have a field day on the surfaces of your cells, right? So you may say, okay, so is this a death sentence? Well, thankfully it's not, right? Because the thing is, there's a drug known as eculizumab, right? Eculizumab, it's a drug that was invented a couple of years ago. It's a monoclonal antibody against C5, right? And again, think about it, if you bind up C5, then you'll never form C5b. And if C5b is never formed, you can never form the membrane attack complex. And if you don't form the membrane attack complex, you don't blow holes in the walls of cells, okay? And one unusual, I guess, question that your friends at the MBME can throw on the USMLE exams is that, how do I put this? They can tell you that, oh, they can essentially give you a question about a patient that has PNH, and then they tell you that, oh, prior to starting drug therapy for blah, 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 which of the following is the next best step in management, right? For those kinds of questions, you want to think about vaccinating those people against like Neisseria meningitis. Because remember, I said earlier in this podcast that whenever you have a deficiency of the terminal complement component proteins, you have a high risk of recurrent Neisserial infections. So the thing is, when you give a patient eculizumab, you're essentially inducing a terminal complement component deficiency with pharmacology, right? Because you're essentially taking C5 out of commission. So those people in general actually need, before you start eculizumab, you would ideally want to, at least maybe like, you know, like a few weeks before, you would ideally want to give the patient the Neisseria meningitis vaccine, right? Because again, by taking C5 out of commission, you can create serious Neisseria problems for patients that are on eculizumab. That's a very nice way your friends at the MBME can integrate immunology with microbiology on the test. So those are, I think that's all I'm gonna say about how the complement system works. But let me kind of talk about some of the complement proteins and their key functions, right? So like C3a, C5a, right? Those are high yield to know because they're anaflatoxins, right? So you may say, okay, Divine, what do you mean by the term anaflatoxin? Well, the thing I mean is that C3 and C5a, they can non-specifically kind of bind to mast cells and make them degranulate, right? And that can trigger an anaphylactic reaction, like a hypersensitivity style reaction, right? So that's why they are called anaflatoxins. Now, C5a, you want to remember that it's a powerful chemotactic factor for neutrophils and other inflammatory cells. This thing is floridly high yield to know for the USMLEs. C5a, it attracts neutrophils and other inflammatory cells. The thing is, there are also some other things that are actually pretty good chemotactic factors for neutrophils. And you want to, again, commit them to memory for the USMLE step one. C5a is the first one. But other ones you want to keep in mind are things like interleukin 8, okay, and leukotriene B4, okay. So C5a, IL-8, and LTB4 are all powerful chemotactic factors for neutrophils and actually other immune system cells. And then C3b, it's very good for the purposes of opsonization, okay? And C3b, I mean, if you remember earlier, I said something about C3b being converted by factor I to inactive C3b or IC3b. The thing is, IC3b actually has the ability to do something called ADCC. ADCC is like antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity. I will talk about that in a later podcast. So those are kind of again, some big things you want to know. I already talked about your C5, B, C6, C7, C8, C9 that are all kind of involved in the formation of the membrane attack complex. So again, those are big things you want to commit to memory for your exam. So now I'm going to, I guess, go ahead and talk about the adaptive immune system, right? Your adaptive immune system, again, like I said, it's mostly your Bs and your Ts, your B and your T cells. And the thing is, all your adaptive immune system cells, they're actually born in the bone marrow, okay? They're actually born in the bone marrow. But the thing is, they complete their maturation, most of those cells complete their maturation elsewhere, right? Like the poster child is the T cell. The T cell is born in the bone marrow, but it kind of finishes up its livelihood, kind of finishes up its maturation essentially in the thymus, okay? Remember the T in T lymphocyte for T in thymus. And the thing is, all these the stem cell that ultimately forms many of these Bs and T cells and all these neutrophils and all that stuff. The thing is, that stem cell can actually go down two pathways. It can either go down a myeloid pathway or it can go down a lymphoid pathway, right? It kind of depends on the kinds of signals you get. And again, like I said, T cells, they complete their maturation in the thymus. B cells, they actually do complete their maturation in the bone marrow. So let's, I guess, kind of talk about some of these high yield Let's talk about some of these high yield cytokines that you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? So if, for example, you want to proceed down the pathway of the lymphoid pathway, the thing you actually need for that process to happen is something called interleukin 7. IL-7 actually helps you go from the pluripotent stem cell down the lymphoid pathway, right? And then obviously from that lymphoid pathway, you can form a lateral killer cell, you can form a T cell. Remember, T cells in general all have CD3, right? And then if you're a helper T cell, you have CD4. If you're a cytotoxic T cell, you have CD8. And then those your lymphoid cells can also form B cells, right? Remember, B cells, they give rise to plasma cells, right? Now remember, B cells have things like CD19, CD20, CD21 kind of deal. But if that's your lymphoid lineage, right? If you want to really go down the myeloid lineage, you need things like GM-CSF, right? So granulocyte macrophage colony stimulating factor. The reason you have those names, right, is macrophage, right? Your macrophages are part of your myeloid cell line. But granulocytes, right? Remember your granulocytes, you can remember them with the mnemonic BEN, right? So like basophils, eosinophils, neutrophils. So those are BEN cells, if you may. You can form them by, again, like by having like GM-CSF. Another thing that actually kind of helps in that process is like interleukin 3. It helps you, again, go down the myeloid lineage. And some key things I guess you want to keep at the back of your mind here is, if, for example, a person, you know, gets chemotherapy for like some bad malignancy and their white blood cell count is like knocked down, right? So they become like profoundly neutropenic. You can actually treat that by giving a drug, right, that again will promote differentiation down this myeloid lineage, right? So you can give like a GM-CSF analog like sagramostim, right? So like I think that's spelled like sagramostim. So you can give a sagramostim. Alternatively, you can give a GCSF analog. So GCSF is just like a granulocyte colony stimulating factor analog, right? A drug like filgrastim. And then, again, that myeloid stem, like you can go from the pluripotent stem cell with like, again, like I said, IL-3, GM-CSF, GCSF. You form the myeloid stem cell. And then the myeloid stem cell can become like, it can become an eosinophil. Usually you kind of need like interleukin 5 for that to happen. Or you can expose that myeloid stem cell to erythropoietin. Remember, EPO comes from the kidneys, right? That's why if a person has a chronic kidney disease, they can get like a normocytic anemia with that, right? So erythropoietin from the kidneys, right? They go and convert that myeloid stem cell to like erythrocytes, like red blood cells ultimately. And remember, if a person, again, has CKD, you can give them an EPO analog, right? So like you can give them things like darbepoietin, right? Darbepoietin is an EPO analog. You can use it to treat normocytic anemia in patients that have CKD. And then if a person has like a tumor, right, that's secreting a ton of EPO, right, like a renal cell carcinoma, right, those things can make those people have like high hematocrit, because again, they are producing a ton of red blood cells because that myeloid stem cell is being exposed to all this EPO. So all these cells are differentiating down the lineage of becoming red blood cells, right? Another classic EPO secreting tumor on MDM is a hemangioblastoma. Remember, that has an association with VHL, von Hippel-Lindau, right? So if a person has VHL, they'll secrete a ton of EPO. The hemangioblastoma they have, usually it's in the posterior fossa, like right around the cerebellum, secretes a ton of EPO, and that ultimately gives rise to polycythemia. Okay. So in all those processes, again, you ultimately end up forming like your red blood cells. If you say, okay, you know what, how about I want to form platelets, right? Remember, platelets come from megakaryocytes. So the thing is, if you actually want to form megakaryocytes in the first place, kind of like we used erythropoietin for red blood cells, you use thrombopoietin for platelets. Right, so if you want to go down the megakaryocyte route, you need thrombopoietin, and then those megakaryocytes, you can convert them to platelets, right, with like interleukin-11, right? Interleukin-11 helps you convert like megakaryocytes to platelets. So is there any like higher pharmacology here? Well, of course there is. If you go back to one of my earliest podcasts that I made on the website, I call it like, I think it's like immunopharmacology and the monoclonal alphabet. I talk about some of this pharmacology that I'm going to, I guess, sort of mention in passing here, right? So like if, for example, a person has like a disorder where, you know, they don't have like many platelets like ITP, right? So like immune thrombocytopenic purpura. One way you can actually treat that is you can give like a thrombopoietin analog. There's this drug that occasionally pops up on the USMLE step one. It's known as romiplostim. Romiplostim is a thrombopoietin analog that can be used to treat like ITP. Remember, again, in ITP, the thing that happens is that you make autoantibodies against GP2B3A, right? So that aggregation step of primary hemostasis doesn't work out so well. And when you form those antibodies, that also clobbers down your platelet population, right? So it'll be a person that, you know, presents on an MBME, they've been having like nosebleeds and bleeding gums and all that crap that kind of started like, you know, like a week or two ago. And then they will give you like a CBC and you notice that everything is fine, but you have an isolated profound thrombocytopenia. If you see that, think about ITP, especially in the patient that has a history of lupus. Alternatively, instead, if you say, okay, you know what, I don't want to give a thrombopoietin analog, how about I go ahead and give you something that activates thrombopoietin receptors? There's this drug known as eltrombopag, so E-L-T-R-O-M, eltrombopag, P-A-G. Again, I talk about all this pharmacology in the Immunopharmacology podcast, but eltrombopag is a thrombopoietin receptor agonist that you can use to treat ITP. So again, these are essentially the different ways you go down these different cell lines and form these things, right? So again, ultimately, like basophils, they're part of your myeloid lineage, your eosinophils, they're part of your myeloid lineage. Again, remember, you need interleukin 5 for that to happen. And then like your macrophages, your dendritic cells, all those things, again, they are all part of your lymphoid lineage. So what are some, I guess, other things, because I really want to try to keep these podcasts short. I'll just make them like a multiple series in like rather quick succession, but I want it to be something you can say, okay, let me just take a 30-minute study break and study. In fact, you know what, maybe let me go ahead and pause here. I will go ahead and continue this in the next series of this. But again, as I do at the end of every single podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, step 1, 2CK, 2CS, step 3. The preclinical exams you take in med school, third year shelf exams, I tutor for all those things. And then if you're a medicine resident and you're preparing for like the in-training exam or the ABIM board exam, I tutor to all those things. If you're a college student and you need tutoring for like physics, gen chem, O-chem, physiology, biochemistry, histology, I tutor for all those things, right? And then I offer this thing I call like longitudinal tutoring, where I work with people for like a year leading up to like a big exam, right? So classically, like I work with like first and second year medical students. I tutor them like for all their like class exams leading up to step one. But the thing is, as I tutor them for those class exams, I also infuse step one knowledge along the way longitudinally. So it's almost like studying for your classes and studying for step one at the same time, right? I also do kind of like the same thing with third-year med students. Like again, I start with third year with them, and then I tutor them for all their shelf exams. I tailor my tutoring specifically to like their shelf exams and also for step two. So when those people hit their dedicated periods for those respective exams, they feel so much better prepared. And again, I've had like wildly successful results with this. And then I guess the other thing I also offer is I do like one-on-one like consulting or coaching for like applications. So like the ERAS application if you're applying to residency, or the AMCAS application if you're applying to med school, right? So like things like personal statement editing, plus personal statement writing, editing applications, mock interviews, all those things. I've done that with like just tons and tons and tons of students. So if you need help with any of those things, reach out to me either through the website, or you can send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I'll see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you.